Welcome to In the Hive. I'm Roger McDonough. And today we're speaking with two University of Utah researchers who have been carrying out studies on the illness COVID-19. COVID-19, by the way, does refer to the illness, not to the novel coronavirus that causes it. But as you'll hear from the conversations ahead, the virus and the way our bodies respond to it is the cause of more than pneumonia, as if pneumonia wasn't bad enough. One particular complication of our experience with this deadly virus is tied to the normally helpful processes it triggers inside of our bodies, as our immune system kicks into high gear to try to fight it off. Except, in many instances, some irregular responses from the body's immune system to the virus are a large part of the problem. Our first conversation today is with Dr. Robert A. Campbell. He's an assistant professor in the University of Utah's Department of Internal Medicine and was the lead author on a study that looked at the onset of heart attacks, strokes, and other serious complications in some COVID-19 patients. Dr. Campbell says that the culprit of sorts in many of these instances is platelets.
We have billions of these small little cells that float in our body, in the circulation in our blood. And when we cut ourselves or when we get injured, they act as a way to plug that injury and prevent you from bleeding. A lot of us think about them in the sense of, like, you know, I had a loved one that had a heart attack or a stroke. So they play a significant role in the development of these complications from a heart attack or stroke perspective. So we were interested in if an infectious disease like COVID-19 altered their function.
Okay. And so, yeah, let's jump into the topic at hand. I mean, yeah, right. You're pointing out that clotting, while good for, you know, stopping bleeding, can also lead to these problematic things like heart attack and stroke that you just described. But as far as COVID-19 patients go, are we seeing a significant number of those patients who are developing blood clots or who suffer strokes or heart attacks? Or how prevalent is, you know, that in these patients?
So this is an exciting time for scientists like myself, because this is a new, it's a new disease that we don't understand, that nobody really has an understanding of the pathologies and the complications behind them. There have been reports from China and New York and elsewhere in the world that, you know, there are younger patients that have that have blood clots like strokes. It seems that COVID-19 patients are more at risk for the development of these complications. And in our study, you know, there's a lot of things that go into why somebody develops a stroke or has a heart attack, and platelets play an important role in that. And we wanted to sort of tease out specifically if these cells were changed in that disease process.
So let's talk about how you conducted the study, because you did gene analysis. This wasn't gene analysis on the novel coronavirus. It was gene analysis of the platelets in patients who have the virus. Do I have that right?
Yeah. So platelets are a little bit odd in the sense that they get all their genetic information from their parent cell called a megakaryocyte. So whatever the platelet has when it goes out into the circulation is basically it's fixed. It doesn't change in general. So what we were able to do is we were able to isolate platelets from COVID patients along with healthy donors to give us a reference and sort of see what changes in their genes or the nucleic acids that are responsible for making new proteins and things, and if they were different between the healthy individuals and COVID patients.
And the answer is, yeah, they were.
Yes. Yeah. And maybe not surprising that there are changes, and there are a lot of changes that, and some of the changes we were able to look at also patients that had influenza and sepsis, so other types of infectious diseases that aren't COVID, but that also can change the platelet genetic code. And we saw that there are differences, and it may explain why COVID may be a little bit more different than influenza or for other infectious processes like sepsis. So, and now that's what we're trying to dig into going forward, is are these changes, how these changes are affecting the platelet and how these changes are different from other disease settings.
That's interesting because, this is probably extrapolating too far, but, potentially one of the reasons that COVID is more deadly is because of these exact changes, but you can't say that yet.
That's a little bit outside the scope of what we study, but I think it's a valid point that, you know, dissecting the changes in the platelet by looking at changes in one cell type. Now, again, there's a lot of things that contribute to the disease process, but are there differences that we can tease out that may explain some of the different observations that we're having in this patient population?
So what, I mean, there are obviously genetic differences, as you just described, in the nucleic acids, and the as far as the differences between those patients who are healthy or who have something like pneumonia or sepsis and those who have COVID-19. What's the sort of practical impact of those changes in the platelets in these patients?
So what we were able to see is that the platelets actually, that there were two things that changed, I should say. One is the platelets became a lot more sticky. I think that's a good terminology to use, because when you activated them, they stuck together more. And maybe that's why individuals clot more, potentially. And the other thing that we found is that they also like to interact with other immune cells, like neutrophils and monocytes that circulate. And when platelets stick to other cells, that it alters their function. So this twofold process of the platelet changing and sticking to itself, as well as platelets sticking to other cells, can change inflammatory processes that are going on in the body, and also lead to other things that may necessarily not be good for a patient,
including that clotting that we were describing before, or unwanted clotting, I guess. I mean, is this all kind of analogous to what happens in autoimmune diseases? I mean, this is the body's response. Of course, the genetic changes. Maybe the question to ask is this something that you've seen before in terms of these specific kinds of genetic changes?
So we recently had another study more looking at the role of other viral diseases in influenza and dengue. So a hemorrhagic fever that's more common in South America and in the tropical regions. Influenza is sort of more worldwide, but the viruses change the platelet, and we see different immune functions of the platelets that are altered. So one of these proteins that we saw was an antiviral protein that went up, and then platelets, we also saw the same antiviral protein go up. So there's some changes that are similar between different disease processes between COVID and other. So I won't say that the changes that we saw are, we've seen them, some of these changes similarly in other disease processes, but some of the pathways that we've looked at are different. And you know, each viral process or each disease setting that we've looked at, you know, there are differences in how the platelets function, and we don't quite understand why that is, if that makes any sense.
I vaguely follow you. I mean, I think it's a little above my head, but I'm getting there. And I also, I mean, I do kind of want to somehow probe the idea that some of these illnesses that are caused by these viruses, they are causing the body to injure itself. You know what I mean? Like, and that's, to me, fascinating.
I mean, I think it's a very good point. And I think when we think about disease processes in general, even COVID and other influenza and sepsis and these things that attack the body, you know, the body has a normal response. And that's good, because that helps us fight off the infection. But there are times when the body's response becomes over-exaggerated. We know that it's different than normal patients. We think it's a little bit different than other infections that we see from hospitalized patients, but there is a sense that the body, the platelets have changed enough that it may be harmful more than beneficial to the patient. And I think that's what you're sort of driving at with these, the idea of the body becoming overreacting to the disease process that ends up being more harmful to the patient than beneficial.
Yeah. Are the problems that you're looking at in terms of the, you know, the outcomes that you see, and this might not be part of the scope of your study, actually, but so if you can't answer this question, I understand. But are those problems just in the patients who are really sick? You know, we've been hearing about lung damage to otherwise healthy people who have contracted the virus, and you talked about the younger populations of people who are being impacted that way. I mean, are the changes you're looking at across the board? And I guess that probably doesn't really impact on the illness. This is a strange question.
Well, no, I think I see what, and people have asked us this already in some terms related to what you're talking about. You know, we studied hospitalized COVID patients, and we looked at really severely ill individuals in the ICU, and we looked at non-ICU patients. We looked at a whole range of ages and sexes and people with comorbidity, and it, at least initially, our data suggests that if you're hospitalized, your platelets are altered. And again, it this adds to the overall knowledge that platelets may be contributing to the thrombotic or the blood clotting, the clots that these individuals may develop. But what would have been nice and something that we're trying to do now is individuals that have mild COVID or asymptomatic COVID, you know, are there differences in those, and can we tease out maybe the tipping point to when the platelets may change? Because that's something we don't know.
Huh. There is this potential way in your study that you described to treat the hyperactivity that you describe of platelets where they aggregate and become clots or help form clots or connect to those other cells. But what is this potential treatment?
Yeah. So you know, I think everybody has heard of aspirin and think of aspirin as a blood thinner, in the sense that it doesn't thin your blood, but it really has this anti-platelet effect. So when you're taking aspirin for heart attacks, it's going to prevent your platelets from sticking together. And in studies that we performed in the lab, not in actual patients, but using patient samples, when we gave them aspirin, we saw that this effect, this hyperreactivity, went away. Now, by no means is I would say that people need to go out and take aspirin without consulting their doctor, but it suggests that maybe we need to be thinking about clinical trials, randomized clinical trials, where some patients could get aspirin on top of their other medications, and does that see an effect? And studies here at Utah and elsewhere are beginning to look at antiplatelet agents to see if they may be beneficial in treating patients with COVID.
And again, the treatment here is to fight against the body's response to the disease caused by the virus, which is just, it's not mind-boggling. It's not, you know, it's common in so many instances, but to me, it's always interesting that our bodies can be our own worst enemies sometimes.
Yes. No, that's, I mean, when we get heart attacks and strokes, it's our body responding to something. The body is responding poorly, unfortunately. And in this case, you know, we think the virus is causing changes globally to your body that may make your platelets and other factors contribute to this, the blood clotting that we see in these patients.
Well, it's really exciting research, and especially if something so simple as aspirin down the line might be able to help prevent deaths that otherwise would occur, or clots that otherwise would occur, and damage that might otherwise occur. And so kudos on the publication. And anything else you want to add here? I mean, I'm sure we could go a lot more in depth.
You know, we appreciate all the support from the community and the support from the patients that have participated in these studies. It takes a team to do these studies, and we're always appreciative of individuals that are willing to participate in our studies, because they help us answer questions that lead to more questions that eventually will hopefully lead to therapies for patients that are suffering from these diseases.
Again, that was Dr. Robert A. Campbell. Dr. Campbell is an assistant professor in the University of Utah's Department of Internal Medicine and was the lead author on the study we've been discussing, which was published in the American Society of Hematology journal, Blood. Up till now, we've been talking about an immune response in some COVID-19 patients that leads to what Dr. Campbell calls hyperactivity in platelets, which can lead in turn to the formation of blood clots, causing heart attacks and strokes. Now we'll turn to another researcher at the University of Utah who has been looking at yet another way this new coronavirus triggers a response in the body. And again, it's another normally beneficial response that in certain instances can become harmful. Dr. Christian Kahn-Yost is a professor in the Department of Pediatrics with the University of Utah School of Medicine. His study, also published in the journal Blood, describes an immune reaction to the virus in some patients that you might actually call an immune overreaction, which may lead to increased blood clotting, disease severity, and even death from COVID-19. As you'll hear, the start of my conversation with Dr. Yost will sound a little technical because there are a couple of technical terms to define. So give a close listen as we head into this interview. Part of that overreactive defense, an immune response to the virus, that is, has to do with something called NETs, or neutrophil extracellular traps. For those of us who have no idea what that means, Dr. Yost, what are these neutrophil extracellular traps exactly?
Well, thank you very much, Roger, for the question. This is actually some very exciting and relatively new neutrophil biology that many people are now studying. So as we talk about neutrophils, you'll remember from the biology courses you may have taken, that those are kind of part of the infection fighting cells in the body. They're actually the most prominent and the first responding white blood cell when you have an infection or any kind of tissue damage. Now, these cells, their main job is to find infection, gobble up those bacteria or those viruses or those fungal elements, like with a candidal infection, and make them go away. They really are what we call phagocytes. They eat bacteria and kill them. Now, in 2004, there was a group in Berlin that learned about some very new neutrophil biology. So a new way that neutrophils could actually trap and kill bacteria. You can kind of think of it as a kamikaze way to die for the neutrophil that takes as many bacteria with it as it can. This is a process that they call mitosis, but it has to do with the nucleus and the DNA becoming very light and fluffy and mixing with all of these antimicrobial factors, these antibacterial proteins and degradative enzymes that are in the neutrophil. And then the cell spews it out into the extracellular space, and it acts like a fishing net, and it traps bacteria and brings them into contact with high concentrations of these antimicrobial factors. So it's like this neutrophil says, I've done what I can do. I'm going to take as many of these guys with me as I can. And it spews out these nets, which trap bacteria and kill them.
Wow. Okay. And that's obviously an immune response that is generally beneficial for, you know, for patients, for people who are suffering from some illness, from some malady. The study that you conducted looked at patients in which there was a net, you know, this neutrophil overreaction, where these cellular traps sort of do their jobs too well, or what happens there? Can you explain what your study found?
Yeah, so you're hitting right on one of the key points of the study that we've done in COVID-19. Initially, it was thought that this was another way that the neutrophil protects us from infection. And that is true. However, when neutrophils go on to make nets in a magnitude that is too great, or in a place or a time when it's not right, all of these antimicrobial factors, these degradative enzymes, can actually damage the host tissue. So we have studied this really extensively since 2004 and have looked at it in models of sepsis or bloodstream infection. And what we have found is that oftentimes this response by neutrophils can be so over the top in some situations that it actually creates tissue damage. It can damage the vessels so that they become leaky. It can damage the lungs and the kidneys. It can also damage the brain. So it's one of those things where there's kind of two sides of the coin. You've got to have net formation to stay infection free, and that's very clearly shown. But if you have too much of a good thing, it can also cause significant damage. And I think for the study that we're going to talk about today, that's probably a key point, is that these nets are actually creating problems for patients with COVID-19.
How do you, how are you measuring that overreaction? I guess what I mean is, how do you know that it's the overreactive immune response that is causing the problems and not simply the sickness from, you know, say, the deadly virus, the novel coronavirus? Does that question make sense? Like, how do you distinguish the two problems from the damage that they may cause?
No, these are excellent questions, Roger. And these are actually wonderful scientific questions that you're asking. Because you have to be able, in order to define cause and effect, you have to be able to take a certain part out of the equation and say, okay, this is what we're left with. So we've been able to do that in many of these bloodstream infection models, where we can use tools that are available to very specifically target neutrophil extracellular traps and inhibit those. In fact, one of, I think, the key points that comes out of our COVID-19 research is that a specific protein that we discovered in umbilical cord blood is capable of inhibiting these nets, these neutrophil extracellular traps in neutrophils. And so in some of the models that we've done, we have actually treated mice with these net inhibitory peptides. And what we actually find is that there's an almost 70 to 80% increase in survival in these models of sepsis. And we've done the studies to really go in and look in depth, you know, what else are we doing with these net inhibitory peptides, or is it just inhibition of neutrophil extracellular traps that's leading to this improvement in their outcomes? And really, while, you know, we haven't tested every facet of neutrophil biology, everything that we've looked at so far is unchanged by these net inhibitory peptides. And this, I think, gives us really a tool to say, at least in these models of sepsis, bloodstream infections, the nets are a pathogenic or part of the cause of the disease severity.
Does that answer your question? It does. And I get it. You know, it's not the measured response. I guess when you're using these proteins to inhibit, you know, the net overreactivity, for want of a better way of putting it, are you entirely, you know, eliminating that response, or is it just sort of balancing the response with these proteins?
A very savvy question, you know, really getting at. So how can you tell us that these neutrophil extracellular traps are part of the problem if you can't take them out of the equation? And so in the model systems, we've been able to do that, at least in the bloodstream infection models. And so, you know, as we kind of looked at COVID-19, you know, getting back to this study that we're really excited about now, we haven't been able to take nets out of the equation. But based on what we know about neutrophil extracellular traps and their propensity to cause inflammatory tissue damage, as well as serve as kind of scaffolds for activated platelets and other coagulation factors that can actually start to create clots in the vasculature. That's really why we jumped on this study so quickly. But we've been able to recruit almost now 45 patients for this study. And it's been a monumental amount of work that's taken just a bunch of teamwork to really get done. So our findings here, I think if, you know, I had to say that what the key points are, it's that these neutrophil extracellular traps are kind of creating a lattice for activated platelets and other coagulation factors like platelet factor 4, other things that are kind of the glue that holds a clot together. And in collaboration with a group at Cold Spring Harbor in New York City, we were able to look at lung pathology samples from patients that had passed away with COVID-19. And here we saw all of these nets in the lungs and a clot surrounding them full of platelets and this platelet factor 4, which is kind of the glue that holds the whole clot together. And so, you know, all three of these patients that we were able to look at on autopsy, look at their lungs, had these microthrombi scattered throughout the lungs. And this really let us know we're onto something.
Microthrombi being those clots that you're describing. A question that I really want to get to is, you know, you talked about the therapy from umbilical cord blood. How soon can what you've been doing be turned into something practical to help those patients who need it, maybe to inhibit this response and perhaps prevent that clotting and even prevent death?
Yeah, so this is one of the really exciting questions that I'm glad you asked. There are a lot of diseases that are now correlated with excess net formation. It's not just the infections like COVID or a bloodstream infection, but there are some autoimmune diseases where these nets are triggered and they can cause problems there. In the cancer literature, there's an understanding that sometimes these nets can help cancers metastasize. So there are a lot of potential therapeutic possibilities if we can show that these net inhibitory proteins that we discovered in cord blood actually do what we think they will without having other side effects. Now, we're really pleased to be partnering with a Utah biotech company called Peel Therapeutics, and they are trying to really answer that specific question. How quickly can we get this rigorously tested, making sure that it's safe to help in humans with COVID-19 or some of these other diseases? I think our pharmaceutical industry is the safest in the world, and we're really going to have to go through each step to make sure that when we do give these net inhibitory peptides, proteins to patients, it's going to be done in a safe manner, and it's going to be effective in treating an inflammatory disease like COVID-19. And Roger, if I can just take 1 second to add,
please.
I'm part of a 30 or 40 investigator network that is really looking at the role of neutrophil extracellular traps in COVID-19. One of our co-authors, Mikkola Egeblat, who's at Cold Spring Harbor, she has formed this network. And, you know, while we have one potential, way to go about treating COVID with our net inhibitory peptides, many of these other investigators are also looking at other avenues that will target this net over exuberance that creates part of the problem. So, you know, it's one of those things where so many different investigators with so many different talents are coming at the same problem from different ways, all of them kind of around, we think these nets are causing problems in COVID-19. How can we target that? So that's been a wonderful collaboration to have, and to be part of that group, hearing the ideas that everyone is sharing. We're going to do this.
I love it. It's the passion for the investigation that you have, and also just the science that's being done. It's interesting, and obviously it is applicable in cases beyond just COVID-19. I mean, you talked about autoimmune diseases and other instances in which sort of cascading platelets or this kind of clotting can occur because of the overreactive immune response. I mean, this could have applicability beyond, obviously, COVID-19, right?
We do think so. We really are looking to make a difference where we can. And I think, you know, the inhibitor that we have, I think, you know, may end up being very effective. But again, I want to stress this point. These are not ready for prime time, but we're hoping in a 12 to 18 month kind of time frame, we might have done the work necessary to think about testing these in humans. But it's a long, long process, and we're not skipping any steps. We're going to do it exactly right and make sure that when this is ready, that it's going to help people.
Again, that's Dr. Christian Kahn-Yost, a professor in the Department of Pediatrics with the University of Utah's School of Medicine. He's the author on a study published in the American Society of Hematology journal Blood about the immune over-response some COVID-19 patients have and the tiny blood clots that can form as a result, as well as potential therapies to help suppress that response. We'll be keeping the focus on the science of the virus for some of our upcoming shows as well. If you've got questions about the pandemic you'd like us to explore, please reach out to us. Send an email to comments@kcpw.org. That does it for In the Hive here on KCPW, a listener-supported, entirely independent public radio resource. Find podcasts at kcpw.org. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for listening, and please join us again next week.